Welcome to EVN Report and the Examining the Context podcast. I'm Maria Titizian, and today we're going to be diving into a critical topic shaping the future of security and diplomacy in the South Caucasus, the so-called peace agreement between Armenia and Azerbaijan. The March 2025 EVN Security Report titled Aliyev's Performative Gamble, the Draft Agreement on Peace, provides a very comprehensive analysis of the implications of this proposal, exposing the contradictions, strategic maneuvering, and potential consequences for Armenia and the region. And joining me, as always, is Dr. Nerses Kopalyan, the author of our monthly security briefings. And today we're going to unpack the political calculations behind Baku's approach and explore what this means for Armenia's sovereignty and security. Welcome to the program, Nerses.
Pleasure to be here, Maria.
On March 13, as we all know, Azerbaijan's foreign minister, Ceyhun Bayramov, unilaterally announced that Armenia and Azerbaijan had concluded peace negotiations, noting that, you know, all of the 17 articles of the draft peace agreement had been concluded, including the final two unresolved articles or issues that Armenia had conceded to. This included the removal of all third-party forces from the border and the mutual withdrawal of all legal claims in international courts. And this caught everybody by surprise. I remember when we saw the news and was like, how did this happen after 2.5 years of negotiating? And interestingly, that same day, Azerbaijani President Ilham Aliyev used the Baku Forum to launch a harsh attack on Armenia, labeling it untrustworthy, incapable of peace. Your report characterized this as a performative gamble by Azerbaijan. And can you please elaborate on why you qualified it in this way?
Definitely. So what Azerbaijan uses is what we call a dichotomous approach, and they try to collapse the dichotomy, meaning they utilized what may appear to be an utterly contradictory strategy, yet they are speaking to two different audiences. The unilateral declaration by Azerbaijan, the party that has basically been the obstructionist force in the entire peace process, when the obstructionist force unilaterally declares that all the points, chapters of a draft agreement have been reached, that definitely caught everybody off guard. But that unilateral declaration was not directed at Armenia. The Aliyev regime was talking to the West, specifically to the United States. And so in this context, everybody was caught off guard because in essence, it was a contradictory statement. But if you look at it within the specific dichotomy strategy that they had developed, their target was the Trump White House because they were trying to basically position themselves within the so-called America First peace narrative. And so Aliyev's objective was to take the mantle of peace-seeking leader in the South Caucasus and frame a narrative with the White House within that context. This is why he was speaking to the White House with that declaration and not to Armenia. With respect to Armenia, he spoke to Armenia directly at the Baku Forum. So what he had was, at the one hand, talking about peace and declaring that all these 17 chapters of the draft agreement have been reached. Thus, one would assume we're close to signing. But the other end, he's making declarations that Armenia is not ready for peace, that Armenia is a warmongering fascist state, and therefore throwing out a set of preconditions that inherently contradict the very idea of the draft agreement that was reached. So contextually, the reason why I qualified these developments as dichotomous and contradictory is because when we look at it substantively, only performative strategies are designed through a contradictory model, because if things contradict themselves, they cannot be substantively achieved. This is why it is performative. So Aliyev clearly has no intentions of signing a peace agreement or proceeding with these agreed 17 chapters of the draft. What he was doing is he was trying to get ahead of the game, right? Lead the news and somehow find an audience with the Trump administration. And this did not happen in a vacuum. You know, it's very important for our listeners to understand the context. Since December, the Aliyev regime has basically allocated immense resources in DC to make inroads into the Trump White House. They failed to do this with the Trump transition team. They hired up to 4 major lobbying organizations in DC to find access to the Trump team. None of these worked. So next, they doubled down on their relations with Israel, hoping that they could tap into Israel's close relationship with the United States and that Israel could somehow serve as a medium to the Aliyev regime in having access to the Trump White House. That also has not been fruitful as of this discussion. So when we look at the broader contextual approach, we see that Aliyev remained somewhat desperate and frustrated because prior to the elections, right, he doubled down on attacking the Biden administration and he doubled down on basically praising the incoming Trump administration. So he was operating off of the logic that a transactional administration that is indifferent to democracy or democratic attributes would be a better working partner for Azerbaijan than the Biden administration. These hopes that they had and the strategies that they developed simply did not come to fruit. And because of that, Aliyev's team started becoming very, very concerned. So they proceeded to take all the steps that I addressed. And so this unilateral declaration needs to be understood within that broader strategy of attempting to puncture the inner circles of the White House. And within that context, right, that was their audience. This is why I keep making the point that Bayramov's declaration was not towards Armenia. It was towards the United States. If we want to understand Azerbaijan's position vis-a-vis the peace process in Armenia, you simply had to, you know, what's coming out of the horse's mouth. And that's Aliyev directly speaking at the Baku Forum.
You know, you've written extensively about Aliyev's sort of persona, his ideological outlook over the last several years. And it's very clear, I think, to many of us that Aliyev will refuse to sign any peace agreement at this stage. And you say not because in principle he opposes or necessarily has an aversion to the concept of peace, but rather because peace contradicts his immediate interests. Can you please explain that a little bit further if you can?
Definitely. So, you know, in a lot of the discourse in Armenia, you know, pundits, commentators, some of the expert community, they keep making the point that Aliyev will never agree to peace. Yes, we know that. But why? Right? This is the important part, because when we go to the Western capitals and we say Aliyev's not going to sign, even fellow countries that are very close to Armenia in the European Union, for example, in the West, come back and they tell us, no, he will sign, right? But we tell them, no, he won't sign. But the Europeans keep saying, well, it doesn't make sense. We think he wants to sign. He just wants to keep negotiating and getting the best deal, right? We have not sufficiently explained why Aliyev, regardless of the deal that we put on the table, will never sign. And so the whys, right, the causal explanatory factors are very important in qualifying why Aliyev is not going to sign. Arguments that kind of rely on this sort of this Manichaean good versus evil discourse isn't sufficient. And so part of the security report this month was for me to basically utilize a lot of the empirical content out there to explain why Aliyev would not sign. And there are three basically explanatory factors that are consistent with the data that we have. One, Aliyev will not sign because as a rational actor, a peace treaty contradicts his strategic interests, right? So he's not going to sign because it harms its interests. It's a very, very rational calculus. And to be quite honest, okay, let's forget the fact that we're talking about Armenia and Azerbaijan, we're talking about Aliyev and the region. If you have two actors, right, actor A and actor B, and actor A is in such a position of strength that signing a peace treaty will actually limit and weaken their capabilities in relation to actor B. Why would actor A agree? So we're basically using game theory that we utilize in the literature with respect to a rational choice scholarship. And all of the research shows that within the domain of risk and gain, Aliyev risks a lot by signing a peace treaty, but does not gain much because everything that he's trying to position himself to achieve, he's able to do that with this state of unpeace or managed instability. So within from the domain of rational calculus, it's simply not in his strategic interest. Second school of thought that I used to qualify Aliyev's demeanor in trying to understand, or his government's demeanor in trying to understand why they won't agree to a peace treaty, is the whole distribution of power and balance of power framework. Aliyev's greatest achievement, and we've written about this in the past, his greatest achievement is the immense power disparity that he was able to create vis-a-vis America. He's invested everything.
Armenia.
Again, I'm sorry, Armenia, I apologize. Yes, of course, towards Armenia. He has invested immense resources in the last two decades. He structured the institutions of his state, and large chunks of his oil revenues have gone towards establishing an asymmetry between Armenia and Azerbaijan. What a peace treaty does is that it basically freezes Aliyev's capacity to exploit this power asymmetry, because once you have peace, right, you cannot engage in conflict persistence. And peace at the same time is also going to allow Armenia to develop its capabilities and therefore close the power gap, which for Aliyev is a categorical nightmare. So when we tell Aliyev, you need to sign a peace treaty, what he hears is, you want me to throw away 20 years of investments that have put me in a position of power. I can't do that. When we tell Aliyev you have to sign a peace treaty, what he hears is, oh, Armenia wants to catch up with me, right? And therefore disrupt the asymmetry that I've created. Categorically, he cannot agree to that. Of course, he's never going to say that publicly, right? Because diplomatically, that's not a tenable argument. But this remains the underlying logic with respect to distribution of power and asymmetry that explains why he cannot agree to a peace treaty, because for him, that basically means limiting his capabilities, eventually weakening his capabilities, but giving Armenia the opportunity to strengthen its. And the third framework is the domestic variable, right? We've spoken about this extensively. Sadly, there has not been sufficient research in Armenia in trying to understand the effects of a peace treaty on the Aliyev regime. Again, there have been conversations of, you know, wag the tail, wag the dog theory, and how possibly Aliyev doesn't want to do that because he has to deal with domestic issues. Therefore, Armenia makes the perfect outside other, the outside enemy. So they apply all resources towards Armenia and thus mitigating or controlling domestic dissent. That is a very undersurface consideration of the issue. At the institutional level, Aliyev's government is not designed to deal with domestic matters. His system is designed to be consistently at a war footing. So his institutions, his government, the state of Azerbaijan that Aliyev created, receives its nourishment from his persistent conflict with Armenia. You take that away, his institutions have to be completely restructured, and they will fall into a state of stagnation or dysfunctionality because it cannot operate without its nourishment. So the institutions of Azerbaijan self-reproduce by virtue of the conflict with Armenia. And whether it's in the domain of hybrid attacks, whether it's in the domain of kinetic diplomacy, or it's in the domain of direct military incursions, the entire Azerbaijani economy, security apparatus, state system is designed towards that. So when we tell Aliyev you have to sign a peace treaty in this domain, what he hears is, I have to basically rearticulate, restructure the entire system that I've created in the last 15 years. And of course, he's not going to do that. So when we look at all the causal explanations, then it becomes very clear why Aliyev cannot sign, because it basically, from his lens, he's being asked to throw away, again, from his lens, everything that he has created in the last 15 to 20 years. Once we understand it through that domain, then we could go to the West and say, these are the reasons why Aliyev will not sign. And so when we say he's not going to sign, it's not Armenians being alarmist or irrational, or Armenians engaging in the good and bad or good and evil discourse. That's not the point. Here are rational, verifiable, empirically based reasons why Aliyev is not going to sign. Therefore, Western pressure has to be commensurate with those factors if we want Aliyev to think to sign a peace treaty.
Okay, and I also want to come to this whole concept of concessions from the Armenian side. But before we do that, you know, Baku's attempt to use this peace narrative to gain favor, as you said, with the White House backfired, right? Because in an earlier call with Hikmet Hajiyev, a U.S. National Security Advisor, Mike Waltz dismissed Baku's framing of Armenia as the aggressor and instead demanded that Azerbaijan finalize the peace deal and release Armenian prisoners. You know, this was enraging to Aliyev if we see him within the context of how you explained it. And it undermined his strategy. This, again, was further cemented when Secretary of State Marco Rubio had a call with Armenia's Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan just on March 25. The U.S. reaffirmed Armenia as a strategic partner, which you've mentioned in other articles and here in this security briefing as a very important nuance for us to understand, and warned against any escalation in the South Caucasus. Now, the developments between March 13 and March 25, you know, left him diplomatically cornered, perhaps, and exposed, you know, the very strategy he had hoped would grant him leverage with Washington. Now, given the clear U.S. stance, right, in the South Caucasus. So far, we haven't heard from Trump, but, you know, from Rubio and from Waltz on Azerbaijan's destabilizing actions. How do you think Baku will or can it adjust its diplomatic strategy moving forward, or will it?
Right. So Baku's initial objective, as I noted, with this dichotomous approach was to find an audience for the Trump administration by virtue of taking up the peace discourse. And Mike Waltz, a day after Bayram's declaration, spoke with his counterpart, Hikmet Hajiyev. And what happened was, and I could share some of these details because I was in D.C. and I did meet with the NSC team at the White House to discuss these matters. These are not secret. These are now being discussed quite openly. Azerbaijan basically presented the following narrative. Look, we were the first ones to declare an agreement to the 17 points of the draft peace agreement, so Azerbaijan is the country of peace. However, Armenia is the problem, right? Hikmet Hajiyev tried to make the point that Azerbaijan unilaterally declared peace, but Armenia is not ready for peace. Armenia is the problem. So if things heat up or escalate, it's not Azerbaijan's fault because, look, we're taking the mantle, but it's Armenia's fault because they are not serious about it. And this argument did not work with Waltz, right? It did not work with the Trump White House. This is where basically they told Hikmet Hajiyev and Baku that, please don't insult our intelligence. We know very well who the aggressor is, and we know very well who's seeking peace. And the fact that that conversation did not go well, the fact that this entire strategy and attempt to create a new narrative with the Trump administration did not go well, clearly enraged Baku. And the fact that Mike Waltz, aside from talking about regional peace and the need for stability and end the fighting, he interjected the issue of political prisoners, which we all know is a highly, highly sensitive issue in Baku. That is a very, very clear indicator that that conversation did not go well. Because the last thing that crossed Aliyev's mind was a conversation with the Trump administration that would bring up political prisoners and then publicly declare it. And so that was a very, very serious strategic on behalf of Baku. And of course, as you noted, subsequently, right, Marco Rubio's call with Prime Minister Pashinyan directly stated that U.S. policy, right, following up what Waltz said, is a demand for peace, stability, and that escalation for the United States is not acceptable. What is interesting is that if we always look at sort of the pattern of U.S. engagement in the South Caucasus, specifically to the Armenia-Azerbaijan conflict, throughout the Blinken administration, right, Blinken would speak with one party and then to the other. So the United States consistently would speak with both countries. Rubio so far has only spoken to Pashinyan. A subsequent conversation with Aliyev has not happened. Okay. Now, I cannot share the reasons why it has not happened, but the fact remains that Rubio has spoken with Prime Minister Pashinyan, but he has not spoken with Ilham Aliyev. And that is a very, very important indicator that Baku's frustration and their inability to make inroads with DC is culminating in sort of a freezing of tensions. And as I noted at the start of the podcast, what Aliyev had imagined and anticipated, a close working relationship with a transactional United States, has not translated into what he had anticipated. And so within the confluence of those factors, Baku is trying to basically, as you noted, re-articulate its relationship with the U.S. Understanding how the Aliyev regime functions and having a general understanding of their decision-making capacity, they are definitely going to double down on escalation. They had basically understood that the Blinken administration was, Blinken State Department, Biden administration was not escalatory. So they had gotten used to the approach of consistently escalating tensions, right? Knowing that there may be lip service from the United States under Biden, but no concrete action. Aliyev tried his initial approach with the new administration. It did not work. I think he's going to go back to the escalatory thing, strategy, and he's going to test the Trump administration to see if their response is going to be similar to the Biden administration. If the Trump administration tolerates or is not as vocal or robust in its response to Azerbaijan's escalatory demeanor, Aliyev is going to take that as a sign that escalatory mechanisms work. If the Trump administration's response is rigid, as we've seen the last two examples we gave, and it goes to the next level of Vice President Vance or even President Trump making a statement, then Aliyev would have to completely reconfigure his approach. But within the domain of U.S.-Azerbaijan relations, leaving Armenia out of it, Aliyev sees escalatory demeanor as a mechanism of gaining attention from Western capitals after which he says, okay, you know what? I will de-escalate, but talk to me, right? So this is him acting as sort of that quote-unquote spoiled child in a playground trying to get the teacher's attention. And so we need to configure his demeanor within that context. I don't think, based on what we're seeing, Azerbaijan has fully developed a plan B with respect to the United States, because they were so convinced that plan A would work. And they were also very convinced that diffusion of immense resources in lobbying, the Israeli connection, and the logic of transactionalism is going to be sufficient. It's going to suffice. At this point, it has not. So I think Azerbaijan is still in the stage of developing a plan B, but they have not fully developed one.
Yeah, and just for our listeners, when we talk about escalating tensions, you know, from March 16 to 21, and then it's picked up again in recent days, Azerbaijan will continually accuse the Armenian side of firing on their military positions, and the Armenian Defense Ministry will issue a statement saying no such thing has happened. And then just 2 days ago, you know, they did fire on some villages and there was some damage to some homes. So this is what Aliyev is continually doing. And we always see this escalation just before, you know, some kind of an attack or an incursion. So people in Armenia are rather nervous about all of this. And it remains to be seen, like you said, how far he will push it to get the intention that he does want to get. Now, I do want to switch gears and look at it from the Armenian lens. The concept of concessions in negotiations is often misunderstood here, particularly in our political discourse. You talk about bargaining theory that suggests that concessions are a natural part of any mutually beneficial agreement. However, some factions, including, you know, Armenia's opposition, certain diasporan groups and pro-Kremlin circles, have framed concessions as outright capitulation. We hear this word over and over again. How can Armenia's government reframe the discourse on concessions to emphasize strategic gains rather than political surrender to Azerbaijan?
That's a very good question. And I don't think that is the government's responsibility, generally speaking, to go into that discourse, but rather it's the responsibility of scholars, researchers, academics, public intellectuals, commentators, journalists, to have an honest discourse on this and truly understand what's going on. Because whatever the government presents, for understandable reasons, is going to be viewed as political moves and political rhetoric. And in that context, it's not going to have the same level of public credibility, because when something is politicized, you know, in a polarized society, even though Armenia's polarization is minimal, right, you're going to say, well, you know, of course the government is going to say that, right? So it's very important to have entire sectors of civil society, the expert community, and the journalistic community, right? Those who could honestly study these things to say, this is the reality, and this is the politicized interpretation. So let's go, as you noted, into the non-politicized consideration of these developments. Indeed, as you noted, bargaining theory has a lot of literature on this. And the biggest mistake or the biggest misconception that we have in Armenia is that the two parties that are negotiating are on equal terms. They are not, right? And so in that context, when whether it's the opposition or whoever it may be that basically argues Armenia made one concession, for example, where's Azerbaijan's? Or Armenia made three, where's Azerbaijan's? Negotiations and the structure of concessions are not some kind of a sports game where you keep a score. And that is a fundamental misunderstanding. That's the first point. Second, as I noted, when you have a disparity between the two negotiating parties, either you make concessions to achieve your underlying objective, or you start negotiating on a matter of principle that if I made a concession, I demand you to do it, and thus the negotiations collapse. Well, the issue here is that when the weaker party falls into that trap, that is precisely what the stronger party wants. They want to declare a collapse of negotiations and for the right to use force. This is what precisely what Azerbaijan had been arguing since Kazan in 2011. And this is the same argument that made when they invaded in 2020, that negotiations have collapsed. Armenia is refusing to concede. Therefore, I have no other option but to use force. And so engaging in what I call the false logic of concessions basically plays to Azerbaijan's hand. And that is not how these things work. Now, in that context, of course, no one's saying that you make all kinds of egregious concessions and therefore justify it by virtue of the logic that you're presenting. That's not what we're talking about, right? Armenia has concrete red lines. Remember, only up till a few months ago, everybody's making the point that Armenia is going to concede the Zangezur Corridor, That's a red line. That's not even part of the conversation, okay, right? Or other absurd claims were made. So we have to understand the structure of concessions that Armenia makes, the modality of compromise that is achieved, right? And what are the underlying objectives? Armenia's underlying objectives are as follows: maintaining territorial integrity and achieving peace. If in the domain of concessions, those underlying objectives are achieved, then the concessions are strategically tenable because they produce gain. If concessions negate those bottom lines where Armenia's territorial integrity is harmed and peace is not achieved, then those concessions have led to basically a reverse effect and the whole thing collapses. So we should not be looking at these developments through the domain of quantifying or engaging in a scoring of concessions, but rather in achieving bottom line objectives. When we take this to the same approach to Azerbaijan, things become a lot more clear. What is Azerbaijan's bottom line objective? To have conflict persistence, right? So when we look at the literature, right, the literature actually shows that you can make more concessions than the opposing side, but actually achieve your objective, while the opposing side can make less or no concessions and fail to achieve their objective. So this argument that strategically utilizing concessions somehow is an act of capitulation is basically devoid of scholarship, the research out there, or any understanding in the school of thought that shapes bargaining. It's basically ignorant politicized discourse, which sadly is very common in Armenia's pundit circles. Now, Armenia's attempt, the government's attempt at strategic concessions, right, are designed to achieve its bottom line. Removal of third-party forces. Well, sure, if peace is achieved, if the bottom line is achieved, then third-party forces is a tenable option, right, as a tenable concession. Or retracting international criminal complaints in international courts, right, the use of international instruments. Again, that is not being done in of itself. It is a conditional precept that if peace is achieved, then that is an acceptable step. So all of these concessions are basically hinged on the bottom line achievement, which is territorial integrity and peace. Now, if there's disagreement on the modality, level, and scope of concessions and strategy, there could be honest discussions about that. But qualifying every concession as an act of capitulation, where in essence it is being utilized to achieve the two bottom lines, as I noted, these are two disconnected things. From the lens of Azerbaijan, right, we have to understand that asking them to sign a peace treaty is the number one concession from their end. So they view the very act of agreeing to peace as the ultimate concession. So when we talk about concessions, Baku looks at us and says, these concessions that you're talking about are categorically petty compared to what you're asking me to do. Right. And this is why we began the podcast and discussing what we're discussing. Aliyev is saying you're asking me to concede my capacity as mini hegemon. You're asking me to concede my capacity for exercising immense power disparity. You're asking me to concede and give up all that I've achieved in the last 15 years. So the concessions that you're talking about is nothing compared to the concessions that this peace process is asking of me. So when we look at it from that lens, right, we see that this false logic of concessions collapses. It's not about concessions as an act of principle or an emotional immersion in the political discourse. It's about achieving the bottom line. And so when we talk about these things, right, and as I noted, as a lot of the research demonstrates, numerically quantifying concessions are irrelevant. Is the bottom line being achieved? Now, if there are concessions that harm Armenia's territorial integrity, then yes, that is a legitimate basis, right, to criticize. If there are concessions that harm Armenia's ability to achieve peace and therefore develop and become strong, yes, those are legitimate criticisms. But we don't see any of that. So within this contextual framework, then, we can't get stuck in the logic of concessions as a phenomena in of itself, devoid of the bottom line objectives that are actually defining the peace negotiation process.
Well, let me ask you a very simplistic question then, Nerses. Why is Azerbaijan even engaging in these negotiations? If signing a peace treaty at the end of all of this is rupturing his bottom line, therefore, that's why you're calling it performative. But what's the end game? I mean, is peace even achievable?
peace is not achievable as long as all the Oliveves in power, or unless a country like the United States or someone like Trump basically puts a gun to all the Oliveves' head and says, you need to sign because it is in my strategic interest that you sign, right? So unless Aliyev is cornered and given no other option, or he cannot not sign, we're not going to see this government, this dictator signing. But within the domain of maintaining accruing international diplomatic capital, why would you not engage in performative negotiations, right? It would be strategically stupid not to do it, because refusing to negotiate simply makes you an international pariah. So what Aliyev does is very strategically is he engages in negotiations, but creates so many artificial obstacles that overcoming those are going to take such a long time, and some of them cannot be overcome. Therefore, he utilizes negotiations as an instrument of his hybrid strategy. Okay, this is why I've written and we've talked about kinetic diplomacy in the past, right? Aliyev uses the negotiation process to basically pressure and weaken Armenia to the best of his abilities. And so he views the negotiation process as an instrument through which he could maintain conflict persistence, while at the same time telling the international community that we are engaging in a process and I do want peace. So it strengthens his rhetorical posturing. It allows him to maintain his diplomatic capital while at the same time even weaponizing the peace process to achieve some of his objectives regionally. So we should not see Aliyev's engagement in the peace process as a genuine endeavor of achieving peace. Rather, we should see it as a geostrategic tool to achieve or maintain the gains that he has had with respect to his geopolitical posturing. And, you know, in conversation that I have with a lot of people in Brussels, in Washington, those who engage with Baku, it's very, very evident the point that Baku is making indirectly and off the record. They're saying, we're not going to make the same mistake that Armenia made in 1994. We are not going to be in a position of strength and then agree to a peace, right, that allows our enemy to get stronger. So when we look at it within that domain, what Aliyev is going to do is he's going to prolong the peace process for the reason that I've provided, okay? But substantively, this is a performative process because his strategic interests dictate different outcomes.
And so what is Armenia's strategy just to play along with this performance?
It's not a question of playing along with the performance, right? So Armenia's strategy is to utilize continuous international diplomatic pressure to try to convince Aliyev to sign. Of course, as I noted, the probability of that is very, very minimal unless Trump wakes up one day and basically says, little tin pot dictator, you have to sign or else you're going to face my wrath, right? Minus something as that anecdotal, substantially what Armenia's objective is that to continuously accrue diplomatic capital that could be used to pressure Aliyev. Now, pressuring him to sign a peace treaty detracts him from being able to engage in localized incursions or use of force because it creates soft layers of deterrence. So Armenia immersing itself in a peace process, right? Yes, we have an end objective, as I've noted. But even if that end objective with this Aliyev regime is not achievable, the mechanism process of being involved in a peace or negotiations allows Armenia to both accrue diplomatic capital and utilize that as soft deterrence. At the same time, it allows us to buy time, because if there is no negotiations on behalf of Armenia, as I've explained, Aliyev could basically declare they don't want to negotiate. They have irredentist, revanchist, any ist term you want to use that comes out of Baku. And they could justify all of that, right, to use force. So the negotiation process for Armenia is a mechanism of deterrence and the accruing of diplomatic capital as part of a deterrence by denial strategy that we've developed. At the same time, we're buying time to rebuild our military capacities, right? This is why Aliyev is so frustrated, right? To purchase the amount of weaponry that we are doing to basically develop self-defense capabilities. And the reason why, again, as we noted, Aliyev is terrified of the peace process is because he knows that even within this circumstances, Armenia has been rebuilding exponentially faster than they had anticipated. Aliyev in his wildest dreams could not have imagined that Armenia would be purchasing $2-3 billion in Western weaponry or in Indian weaponry. That was never part of his calculation. So now he's thinking, imagine what's going to happen if I give them peace, right? They will close the palace power parity in some 3 to 5 years, which I've spent 20 years, a huge war and ethnic cleansing to preserve. And so we need to look at all of these developments within that framework.
And I promise one final question. What would Trump's wrath look like?
It's really, really simple. Trump's wrath always translates to sanctions. And the greatest fear that the Aliyev regime has are what we call sectoral sanctions. Well, basically, a sector of its economy, i.e. the oil industry, is sanctioned because his entire economy will collapse and therefore his regime will collapse, right? So Trump even threatening to sanction Azerbaijan's oil industry will immediately lead Aliyev to sign a peace treaty because the alternative is the complete collapse of his economy and his regime. So in that context, it's not the United States using force, right? It's not even United States threatening to bomb anything, nothing like that, okay? A simple threat, and not even an implementation, a simple threat of the Trump administration sanctioning the oil industry of Azerbaijan will completely change the entire policy discourse and the approach of the Aliyev regime towards signing a peace treaty.
Well, there you go. Thank you for shedding so much insightful light, if you will, on this whole peace process, because as you noted, we are not talking about it in a way that looks at not only literature and scholarship, but also, you know, negotiations, that have occurred, you know, for centuries among warring parties. So thank you, Narses. We look forward to next month's security briefing as always.
Thank you for having me, Maria. Always a pleasure.